As Charlotte said, I've done a few of these, and it actually is one of the most enjoyable and important things that I get to do, so I appreciate spending this time with you. I was charged with talking a little bit about the management of common variable immunodeficiency, and I'll say a couple things from the outset. One is that, as you know and you've heard and you've seen in your own lives, this is an incredibly variable condition. So I'm going to try to cover in broad swaths what we think about, what we look for, and how we address that. But of course, this may or may not apply to you depending on what I'm talking about. And so I hope that I'll at least spur some questions to think about, to ask us during this weekend, and then, of course, most importantly, to talk about your personal physician, talk about those things. And secondly, I know there's a wide variety of knowledge in the room. So some of you are experts in your own right. You've been living with this. You know a lot about it. Others are, I know, are here for the first time. So I'll try to sort of split the middle, and then in the question and answer, we can get into more complex questions if you have them. So I like to start all my talks from a happy place. This is La Jolla Shores, very close to the office that I have at the University of California, San Diego, and not the worst place to spend an afternoon if you have the time. These are my disclosures. I have worked with a few of the companies that are in the immunoglobulin space. So I won't belabor this. You've heard very elegantly from Charlotte what common variable immunodeficiency is. I'll be a little more succinct and dramatic. It's the immune system in chaos. And I like this headline. This is from Dr. Kaveri, who's in Paris, a researcher in the area. And I think this is right. I think we don't understand all the problems, but not only is this the inability to fight infection, but the inability to regulate the immune system at some level. And so as we talk about the clinical consequences of that and the treatments, keep this in mind. And I like to tell my patients, this is a little bit oversimplified, but it's called common variable for certain reasons. As you heard, everybody with this diagnosis has low antibody levels and low function, as you heard about. Most, but not all, patients have recurrent infection, and many patients are at risk for chronic lung disease, which we are doing a better job of preventing through effective treatments. And most require immunoglobulin replacement therapy. So, of course, we'll talk a little bit about that as the mainstay of treatment for CVID. But there's all this variability, and as you just heard, we don't understand the genetics of this very well at all. So there's a lot of research that needs to be done there, and we recognize each patient may have their own individual signature when it comes to the genetic issues. There's a variety of associated complications or medical conditions. I'm going to cover those for you briefly in the next few minutes. And then individualized treatment. This is a buzzword that permeates medicine, but it's so true with CVID, is that this is not a one-size-fits-all condition, and it's very important for you to work with your healthcare team to find what works best for you. And I'll cover a little bit of that as we go. So you've heard this, and this is Charlotte's data. She should get used to this because I'm going to show a lot of her data here when we talk about complications. The truth is a lot of what we know clinically about CVID comes from her and her team and their descriptions of this large group of patients they've followed. So as she said, almost everybody gets infection, and we're going to start there because that's the hallmark of this condition, that what brings it to attention and what, at least historically, patients with CVID have struggled with. But we're going to also get into some of these other things, autoimmunity, the malignancy risk, the GI problems, and so forth. So the first symptom, infections. And you guys know this. You live it, or your family member lives it. This is brilliant marketing, these little bacterial fuzzy guys. But don't be fooled. These are not fun to live with. They're not your friends in many cases. We know that CVID is largely complicated by respiratory infections. So you see the list there. It could be the upper airway, it could be the lower airway, it could be the ears and the eyes. And we do worry about and still see on occasion more serious infections, meningitis and sepsis as examples. We don't see those as much as we used to, in part probably because of the widespread use of antibiotics, but it still is a risk that we're concerned about, particularly in patients that are not treated or undertreated for CVID. And there are certain patients that have difficulty with viral or fungal infections, though those are less prevalent than the bacterial infections. So it depends on, that may depend on T-cell function, which we have some difficulty measuring at times, but certainly is possible in CVID. So we'll start with the basics. You guys know this. I know you heard about some of the cutting-edge work in antimicrobials this morning from Steve Holland. But we use antibiotics, and we use them at the time an infection is suspected or diagnosed acutely. There's usually sort of a defined and recommended course, and as you know, not all antibiotics are created equally. So it's important the best we can to wrap our arms around what the type of infection and what specific antimicrobial makes sense. Now, the one trick here, which you probably know, but we constantly have to educate our healthcare colleagues about this, is that sometimes people with PID need longer courses. The standard treatment doesn't always work that well or as well as it should. And so it's not uncommon to prolong that course maybe two or three times the usual course. Now, again, that depends on the person and the infection, but it's something to keep in mind with your care. Now, I just want to say a quick word about another strategy, and that's prophylactic or preventative antibiotics. And I think I heard earlier this morning a couple of times, we don't really know the best way to use antibiotics prophylactically in most cases. And I think that's true for common variable immunodeficiency. Taking antibiotics on a daily basis or a weekly basis is beneficial for some patients. In my own practice, it's actually a small fraction of patients that need that, but that can vary from person to person or practice to practice. The difficulty of here, of course, is what's the end point? You're going to take antibiotics for the rest of your life? Maybe, but that can lead to some complications. And I do want to just mention, to be fair and balanced, the downside of that. So we know there are side effects to any treatment that we use. My patients get tired of hearing this, but I say there's no free lunch. Anything we do has a potential downside or dark side to it. So with the antibiotics, of course, it can cause gastrointestinal problems, can cause hypersensitivity reactions or allergies, and it's important to be specific. If you react to an antibiotic or think you've reacted to it, be very specific with your doc about what that reaction was, because that may help us determine whether that's a real dangerous risk or whether it's something that could be managed should you need to revisit that medication. You also, if you came to the breakfast this morning, it's a very interesting breakfast conversation about fecal matter. You know, Steve's an interesting guy, smart guy, but anyway, he talked about C. diff infections, and there's a whole emerging science, as you probably know, about the microbiome, how important the bacteria that live in our bodies actually are, how many of them are actually very helpful for shaping our immune response and controlling regulatory issues in the body. So wiping out or affecting that microbiome can and probably is harmful, particularly early in life in children. So that's an emerging science, but I think I'm fond of this cartoon, which I don't know if you can read. It says, confidence is the feeling you have before you fully understand the situation. So we use antibiotics. We should use them. I'm not saying we don't, but we have to be prudent about that. And we have to realize that when we're messing with the bacteria in the body, even if it's necessary, there can be some backlash to that. And I think we're just learning with this. There's a whole microbiome project, which is, along with the genetics, is a real exciting emerging science. So the last thing, of course, is bacterial resistance. Again, it doesn't mean we don't treat patients with antibiotics when needed, but there is concern, and you heard a little bit at the breakfast about the research going on about new antimicrobials. There's some concern that eventually we will run out. It's really the bug's world, and we're just living in it, right? And so we have to be smart as a public health matter for how we're using these medications. So just to recap this little part, appropriate antibiotic selection, not all are created equal. Be aware of the side effects. Make sure you talk about those with your doc. Complete the prescribed course to make sure you fully get rid of the infection if it's going to be treated. And then just a reminder, I'm not saying we don't use antibiotics. We need them. But a lot of times these respiratory infections are viral, and the antibiotics don't do anything at all, except maybe make the doctor feel better that he's trying to do something. So you certainly can see bacteria coming out on the tail end of that. The viruses damage the mucous membranes, the cilia, the normal clearance factors. So we have to be very watchful, but some of this is viral and will run its course. And if all else fails, you bring in the lawyers, right? So infection may be antibiotic resistant, but let's see how it responds to intensive litigation. All right, so we know in this room, though, that the mainstay of treating common variable is immunoglobulin therapy. And I just put this slide up here as a reminder that, as you heard, immunodeficiency is on a spectrum. And so using immunoglobulin is a judgment call. Often it's very clear, and it's the standard of care if you have a diagnosis of CVID and are suffering recurrent infections. But there are a lot of areas in medicine that are not entirely black and white. Again, we don't have a pointer, but I would point out to you that CVID falls in the upper part of this table. So either non-functional B cells, no IgG, that's sort of, or very low IgG. And so you can see that the need for Ig therapy is incredibly common, as opposed to some of the other immunodeficiencies further down on that list, which are much more common than CVID, and often there are other and perhaps better ways to manage those than going on immunoglobulin therapy. You heard a little bit from Charlotte about IgG, and I'll just, I won't recap exactly what she said, but this is the medication, of course. This is purified human immunoglobulin, or it's largely IgG. There's a little bit of IgA in some of the products, but this is processed, purified, concentrated from plasma donors. And this is really a remarkable molecule that we understand what it looks like. We understand, I think, very little about what it actually does. You see there it says a billion specificity. So I went to the very reliable medical source of Wikipedia. I'm sure you've heard of it. And there was a reference on there. So this does come from a medical journal. 10 billion specific things that IgG can recognize. So it's really quite amazing. Now, there's two pieces to this IgG molecule. Up there at the top of the Y, at the top of the picture, that's the variable or hypervariable region. That's where you get the 10 billion different things can be recognized. And your immune system actually has ways to recombine that so that you can actually learn how to recognize other bacteria, viruses, fungal, and other foreign things. At the bottom is what's called the constant region, and this is the business end of the IgG molecule. This actually hooks up the cells and has the signaling capacities to sort of instruct cells of what's going on, what's seeing, what needs to be cleared, and signal. So that's where all the information flows through. And as you heard, these are produced by B lymphocytes. So IgG has many roles in the body. The two main ones, at least as we understand it, are to protect against invaders, to protect against bacteria, viruses, toxins, and the like. And it does that by both neutralizing these bugs and also then signaling the immune system to clear them, to lyse them, to get rid of them. But IgG also has important, probably regulatory and signaling properties to either access certain immune functions to start, to kick them off, or to regulate them. And there's a lot of interesting research going on now with special types of antibodies, sialylated antibodies, and these are versions of IgG that probably have anti-inflammatory effects, and maybe in the future we'll be harnessing that in a way to treat inflammation more effectively as a regulatory function. So why do we use IgG? Well, everybody in this room knows the answer to that. I'll just show you. There's lots of studies that prove this. The FDA requires these studies to be done so that we can prescribe these treatments for CVID. I like to show this one because this was commissioned by the IDF. This is the IDF at work right here, showing the difference that immunoglobulin therapy makes in people's lives. So you can see before and after IVIG therapy, and across the board you see these significant reductions in infection, whether you want to look at sinus infections, pneumonia, ear infections, bronchitis, even diarrhea, and we're going to talk about GI stuff in a moment, but if there are infectious causes of diarrhea, there may be some role for immunoglobulin therapy to be helpful. So not only does it prevent infection, it keeps people out of the hospital, and this is a good marker for very serious infections, pneumonias, sepsis, meningitis, the types that you can't just treat as an outpatient. So keeps people from getting sick enough that they have to be in the hospital. And it also, maybe even more importantly, gets people out of the doctor's office, away from missing work, missing school, doing the things that they want to do. So there's really no question that immunoglobulin therapy works for the infectious, to prevent the infectious complications of CVID. And that's, again, just to be clear, is the mainstay of treatment for this condition. So just to review things I'm sure you're familiar with, but to make sure that we cover the basics, there's several ways now to give immunoglobulin replacement therapy. The oldest, if you will, but still works very well for many patients, is the intravenous route. That's usually given every 3 or 4 weeks, and most patients will tolerate this well. Although, in up to about 20% of patients, you can have some very significant infusion-related side effects. Because of that, this needs to be done typically under the supervision of a healthcare provider, but it certainly can be done safely in the home, and there's lots of programs that have shown that. A couple pointers, the infusion rate matters. You generally cannot jam immunoglobulin in as fast as you can IV fluids and other things. So that's important. If you're having trouble with your infusions, ask this question. Can we go slower? Because that makes a big difference sometimes. Sometimes the product matters, not for efficacy. The drugs that are prescribed all work. They've been shown to do that. But sometimes for tolerance. There are patients that do better with one product or another in terms of side effects. So that's why we sometimes spend a lot of time arguing with payers to stay on a specific drug if it's working well. And then, as you probably know, pre-medication, things like Tylenol, ibuprofen, antihistamines, are very useful sometimes to prevent some of the minor side effects. Some patients do use corticosteroids with the infusions. I'm not personally a big fan of this because I think it does lead to side effects over long periods of time. The second route to mention is the subcutaneous route. And I will refer to this as conventional or traditional sub-Q because, as you may be aware, there's yet another way to do this I'll cover in a moment. But this is giving immunoglobulin subcutaneously. Has often been done once a week, but now there's a lot of flexibility through some studies that have been done. Can be done anywhere from every day with small amounts up to every 2 weeks subcutaneously. So a lot of flexibility with this route. Doesn't require IV access. It really does remarkably cut down on the systemic adverse events that have been seen with the IV route. But the trade-off is sometimes there are small local reactions that can lead to some discomfort. And this, of course, allows you as the patient or you as the families to have a little more flexibility. You're not relying on a healthcare provider to come do those infusions or having to go to the office in some cases to do the treatments. You can learn to do this on your own and fit it into your schedule. And theoretically, I'll show you some curves in a moment. Theoretically, this keeps the IgG level more stable, which we think is more physiologic. It's more what your normal immune system would do, kind of keep a stable level. Now, that hasn't been proven, to be clear, to be better in any way, but some people anecdotally will say, you know, I do feel a little bit better when that level is not going up and down. And then finally, just this past year, there's been yet another way to give immunoglobulin. That's giving it subcutaneously in conjunction with what's called human hyaluronidase. This is a recombinant protein that actually acts as a diffuser. It actually helps the fluid diffuse into the sub-Q tissue so that you can give larger volumes at one time. And the studies with that approach have shown that you can give a full monthly dose of immunoglobulin subcutaneously in one sitting. So again, this doesn't require IV access. The systemic reactions are still lower compared to the IV routes. But again, local infusion reactions and some temporary swelling do happen. And the potential benefit of this is that a patient could self-infuse after they've had the proper training with this, doing this once a month or so to get their immunoglobulin replacement. So I want to be clear that when you look at the efficacy of these, it looks basically the same. And the FDA is a stickler about this, as you can imagine. They're not going to approve something that's less effective. So I think I can't say that one of these is more effective than the other. This is the best study that's actually looked at this. It's an older study, but this was Helen Chappell's group that actually took patients and did both, did IV and did the conventional sub-Q, and the rates of infections were virtually identical. So I think in terms of efficacy, we can be confident that all these routes of replacement work. And as I tell my patients, you just have to get the stuff in. That's the main thing. Whatever works for you, just get it in. Now, there are these little nuances that it's important to discuss if you're making decisions about treatment. So as I've said, these are therapeutically or from an efficacy standpoint equally effective. There are less systemic events with the sub-Q routes, but more local discomfort. And so that's a trade-off that you have to weigh in your own mind. We do see these more stable serum levels with the sub-Q routes, so so again, if I had a pointer, I'd show you that on that right-hand side, there's the sub-Q. That's conventional sub-Q given once a week. You see the IV is a little bit more like riding the roller coaster, okay? And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It just means you, when you infuse it IV, you get a high level, and over the course of the 3 to 4 weeks, you use that up and you get a lower level, and that's the trough. And so the sub-Q traditional method is often more frequent, though there's a lot of flexibility from daily to every 2 weeks. And there is a little bit of data. This last study, it's almost cut off on the, well, on my screen, you can see it. This last study showed there was some improvement in quality of life for patients using sub-Q. I will tell you that that was based in comparison to people that were going to the hospital to get their IV infusions. And I think a lot of the quality of life involves having to go to the office or the hospital to do all this. So IV infusions in the home, I think, do improve on some of those potential differences. The other thing I'll show you quickly, this new route with the hyaluronidase, that's the dashed line in the middle there. So it kind of splits the difference in terms of levels over time. You don't get the high peak that you do with the IV, but you do get a little bit more of a degradation or a lower trough level at the end compared to doing it weekly with the conventional sub-Q. So that's just to give you an idea of what the levels look like as you do these different treatments. Again, this has not been shown to be clinically important in large groups of people, but for you personally, sometimes these levels may have an effect on how you feel overall. So I always say, like I said, go forth, be happy, let's pick what works for you, and to each his own in terms of how this is actually done. What are the risks? So like I said before, no free lunch. We have to be, there's always a downside, the yin and the yang of life, right? So here's the potential risks of IG treatment. Anaphylaxis has occurred. It's extraordinarily rare, but it does happen. And so that's mainly been seen with the IV route, which is why it's nearly a requirement that a healthcare provider be there with you in case you have a very severe allergic reaction. These are blood products. They've been very, very safe blood products historically. But as I tell my patients, I cannot give you 100% guarantee there will never be an infection from a blood product. So you should be at least be aware of that. Aseptic meningitis, renal failure, thrombosis and stroke, these are all very rare complications, but of course they're very serious complications. So it's something we have to constantly be on guard for and be watchful for as people are treated with immunoglobulins. And then the milder events happen much more often. So these typically have been described with greater frequency with the IV routes, but some of these have also been seen with the sub-Q routes, including the headache. And so things like chills and fever and achiness are things that some people have to manage that. We don't generally stop the treatment because it's too important, but we have to manage these things and recognize that these are not uncommon issues. And so this is complex. This is not sort of, as I said, one size fits all. So we have to, I'm going to talk a little bit about dose in a moment, but we have to consider the dose. There are various product choices that sometimes make a little bit of difference in side effect profiles for certain patients. We look at the frequency it's given. I've talked about the routes that it's given. I'll talk a bit about monitoring levels. But most importantly, and I think this will hopefully resonate with you, is about clinical effect. We want to accomplish the goal here of reducing the infectious complications. So that may be the most important thing on this slide in terms of making this all work to achieve the clinical effect. And then, of course, monitoring for adverse events. So while it's very important to get access to IVIG therapy, standard of care for CVID, just having it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be optimal. And this is where it's worth spending some time with your physician, or if you need to get a second opinion and see someone who's more knowledgeable, there are often a lot of tweaks that can be made to make this work as well as possible. So let's talk a little bit about dose and level, because this is an area I think, well, our office spends a lot of time on this and actually arguing with payers about this. This is older data. This is Vinny Bonagura's data, and I don't think Vinny's here, but of course very well known in the immunodeficiency world. And I give Vinny a lot of credit. He took a lot of time and effort to point out something, publish it, which we see every day in clinical practice, the fact that this is not a one-size-fits-all and that there's a what's been called a biological trough, probably unique to each patient. So let me walk you through this quickly, and some of you I'm sure have seen this. What Vinny faced is what we face often, and you face as patient, is that the payers say, okay, we think you should be in this level. And that shaded area is what the policy of the insurance said. As long as you're between 400 and 600, that's good enough. That will cover you. You should be fine. Well, of course, I see a lot of heads shaking. We know that's not true. We see it all the time. But he actually proved it. And if you can notice, he started the immunoglobulin. On the left-hand side, you see the S and the P. That's sinusitis pneumonia. Okay? And what he noticed was that if he didn't keep that patient above that dashed line of 900, they were sick. And they were real sick. They had recurrent pneumonia. So for that patient, if he could keep that level above 900, the patient did very, very well. Had nothing to do with this 400 to 600 that the insurance company had plotted out. The second patient, similar story. Again, 400 to 600 suggested by the payer. For this patient, it was 700. Below that line, you see pneumonia. The OM is otitis media, ear infection. And then pneumonia again. So these are serious infections, and he had to keep the patient above 700. Then they ticked along very well. So it's not always this straightforward, but it highlights how everyone with this condition is variable, is unique, and we have to work to try to find the sweet spot in terms of treating with the right dose of immunoglobulin. Now, other groups have tried to take a broader view of this. This is a study, important study published by Jordan Orange, who I think is here at the meeting. And Jordan was able to pool together a bunch of studies that looked at this very serious issue of pneumonia, and show that there's a nice steady line, and there's some variability. You can see those dots don't all line up perfectly, but this is called a meta-analysis, and it basically tells us that if you look at the whole of the data, these many studies over a period of time, that there is a significant reduction in the incidence of pneumonia up to a level, IgG level of 1,000. And so this is some of the rationale for pushing, if people are getting sick, keep pushing that level at least up into a trough of 1,000. We don't have a lot of data beyond that number, although I'm sure some of you could share stories that you need to be somewhat even higher than that. But this is very compelling data from large groups of people that, at least if you look at pneumonia, higher levels can be beneficial for some people. And then Helen Chappell's group took this a bit further and said, what do we have to do to actually get people infection-free? Not just pneumonia, but how about all infections? And she again showed this tremendous variability. So mainly pay attention to the red lines here, the purplish line, or the more red lines. That's the CVID group. She looked at X-linked agammaglobulinemia as well. But you can see, in order to keep people infection-free, some people did great at a trough of 600. That's all they needed. They didn't need, they had no infections. But there were a few people that he didn't even need to be at 12 or 13 or 1400. And everything in between. So we have to be very cognizant that each person is an individual and we have to try to work to find the right dose of immunoglobulin. So this is Steve Jolly's paper. Steve's here also. I really like this slide because it shows a couple of things. All the things that I've touched on a lot of these, not all of them, but all the variables that go into making decisions about immunoglobulin replacement therapy. And what it highlights is what we all know is that as much as the science is important, there's still an art to this. There is still an art to finding the right treatment, the right dose, the right management of side effects for each individual patient. And we have to spend a lot of time convincing some of our colleagues about this, okay? So this is our job as your partners in this condition, as your advocates, but it can be a bit frustrating sometimes. All right, so that's infection. We can, of course, take more questions about that later, but let's move to some of the other issues. I actually think infection, while still a major issue, we're better at handling that than we're handling some of these other issues, and so I want to give them fair time. This is, again, coming in large part from a lot of Charlotte's work, showing all the other things that can happen and have been observed in CVID as associated conditions that, for the most part, probably don't have a lot to do with infection. There are some places where infection, viral infections, may play a role. And you can see there is hepatitis B and C there, but things like splenomegaly and GI problems and hemolytic anemia and all the autoimmune issues and granulomatous disease, these are probably, near as we can tell, not always infectious problems. And so let's talk a little bit about these. And let me be clear, I don't put these up here to make anybody anxious. I figure, as was said, you can go online and read all this stuff yourself. So I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. But I know many of you are facing and managing some of these issues, and so I do want to say a few words about it. So lung disease. Lung disease, at least historically, has been one of the major issues. And if there's an end organ that takes a brunt of the issues of common variable, it's either the lung or the intestinal tract. But the lung is one that we spend a lot of time looking at and monitoring. And there's a laundry list of things that can happen in the lung. So you can get bronchiectasis from recurrent infection. There are interstitial or restrictive lung diseases that probably have nothing to do with infection but seem to show up commonly in CVID. You can have asthma, but you can have other obstructive problems that are not asthma. You can get granulomas in the lung, and then some of you may be familiar with this lymphoid interstitial pneumonitis, which is probably related to granulomas, but there's some variability in what that looks like for different patients. And so in the lung, it's really about identifying the problem. So this is an early microscope. They were able to tell this was a mammoth. And you can get fooled. As Charlotte said, I don't know how many patients I've seen that come in and said, yeah, I have asthma. It's terribly controlled. I take all the asthma medicines. It doesn't matter. And they don't have asthma. They've just been told that because it's common and that's the first thing people jump to. So when we look at the lungs in CVID, we have to consider a number of things. And some of those are infectious. We've kind of covered those, all the different places you can get infections in the respiratory tract. But some of them are not. So you can have structural problems, the biggest one being bronchiectasis, probably from recurrent infection and the damage that takes place from those infections. You can have inflammatory processes that cause interstitial lung disease, and these granulomas are inflammation at some level. And then it's not that much more common in CVID compared to normal folks, but you can have tumors, you can have cancer, and you can get lymphoma in the lung in rare cases. So we have to ask these questions very carefully and not just assume that it's always infection or always something common like asthma. How do we do that? Well, it's very important. I hope most of you are doing this, but if you're not, it's important to ask about this. Are you monitoring your lungs? And really, we do that mostly by symptoms, so paying attention if you're having more cough, more shortness of breath, any respiratory issues. But also, pulmonary function testing is important. And while there are no hard and fast guidelines, most experienced immunologists that treat immunodeficiency would say it's a good idea to do your lung function every year or so, sometimes more often, sometimes less often. But especially if there's any abnormality that shows up. If you start to have a change in symptoms, really important to see how well the lungs are functioning. This is a non-invasive test. Many of you have done it, spirometry. And so you can measure how well the lungs are working mechanistically. Chest imaging is not something that I do in every patient. And chest imaging is a little more complicated because mostly what we're talking about here is CT scans. You can get some basic information from chest x-rays, but you don't get the level of detail to catch many of the things that we see in CVID. CT scanning, of course, involves radiation. Radiation can be a problem, especially if you get a lot of it over time. And there's a little bit of data. Charlotte may know more than I do about this, but a little bit of data. We have some concerns that CVID in certain patients, they could be radiosensitive. And so you may see more side effects over time from this type of exposure. So I don't want you to leave here thinking everybody should go out and have a chest CT scan. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that if there are concerns about your lung, either that show up on your lung function test, or if you have symptoms that are not responding to the usual easy things that should be done, it's not the worst idea to discuss that sort of imaging just to make sure something structural or inflammatory is not going on. And then from there, you work with your doctor to sort of what's the best monitoring plan for that, depending on what's seen. We talked about managing sinopulmonary infections, of course, very important in preventing those with immunoglobulin. Anti-influenza treatment. This is, I think, pretty important. I'm an advocate. Not everybody, all the experts may agree on this. I'm an advocate of the non-live flu vaccine. I think there is some data to show that helps kick your T cells into action, even if your B cells don't work very well. And it's also probably true that immunoglobulin products don't protect you as well to influenza as they do other infections. Remember, this is a virus that mutates pretty much every year, and so the immunoglobulin collected from last year's donors isn't going to do that great a job necessarily protecting you against this coming year. So I actually think the flu shot, if it doesn't cause problems for you, is a low-risk endeavor that may help. And then having anti-flu medication is a reasonably good idea during the flu season, so you can take that if you come down with influenza. And the last one, I view it as a no-brainer, but I gotta say it, don't smoke. It's bad for everybody, but it's really bad if you have lung problems or are predisposed to lung problems because of immunodeficiency. Alright, moving on then. Autoimmune disease. This is also incredibly common. Charlotte's data has shown about between 25 and 30% of patients. You will read some literature that suggests it's higher and some that it's lower, but I think that's a pretty good estimate. We don't know the reasons why autoimmunity shows up so commonly in CVID. It's this immune system in chaos, and certainly there are probably regulatory properties that are not functioning right in CVID. A couple of the tricks with autoimmunity, as you may know, is that the diagnostic testing can be very tricky. That's because, a lot of the diagnostic tests that rheumatologists use are, guess what, antibody assays. Well, you don't make antibodies normally, so you may not be making those antibodies that they're looking for that they think are causing the problem. Secondly, if you're already being treated for CVID with immunoglobulin, guess what? Those antibody assays are mostly just measuring what you infuse into your body, either weekly or monthly. So there's a lot of noise in the testing, and it's very important to work with a good clinician, somebody who can listen to your symptoms, do a good exam, and not rely quite so heavily on the lab test. Doesn't mean you don't do them, but it means you have to be very skeptical about the interpretation sometimes. And then, as you may know, autoimmune conditions, if they're severe enough, require immunosuppressive treatment. You have to try to rein in the immune response so it's not doing damage to the body and the organs. And again, amongst things that my patients get tired of hearing me say, it's walking the tightrope with those meds. You have to give enough medicine to help with the autoimmune problem, but not so much medicine that you cause major infectious complications, because now you're knocking your immune system down even further than it already may be with the CVID. So this is, I'm not going to spend time talking about all these, but just so you understand the range of things that have been reported from an autoimmune standpoint in CVID, and I'm sure many of you have these diagnoses or have been evaluated for these diagnoses. So it ranges from everything from skin problems to hematologic problems. Those are actually the most common, the hematologic issues, low red counts, low platelets, low white counts. And so we see that very often in CVID. Endocrinology issues, the pure rheumatologic problems, which are either vasculitis or joint issues like rheumatoid arthritis. And then I'm going to spend a little more time on the GI issues, but some of the gastrointestinal problems are clearly autoimmune. So inflammatory bowel disease, there's a Crohn's disease-like condition that we see sometimes, and things like autoimmune hepatitis. And so I've mentioned this, and this holds true in some part for the GI portion of the talk, but these immunosuppressive medications, they're important. If you're suffering with one of these autoimmune conditions, this is really the treatment as it stands, is to select one of these and use it very cautiously to try to calm down the immune response causing that autoimmune inflammation. But understand, as I'm sure you do, that these compromise the immune function even further than is done with the CVID. So I've just listed some of those. Many of you have seen these names before, but corticosteroids, azathioprine, methotrexate, cyclosporine, mycophenolate, these are all formulations of drugs that mostly target T cells, but remember the T cells, as you saw, direct the B cells. So by affecting T cell function, you actually, in many cases, will affect the B cell function also. Now in CVID, we don't worry so much about B cell function because we know it's already lousy. Okay? But these drugs actually affect that arm of the immune system that we think in most people is still working pretty well. And so this is the concern, is that you knock down the T cells. Now you have two systems that aren't working as well as they should be. On the right-hand slide, there's some other treatments. So rituximab, as you may have heard, is a very targeted therapy that knocks out B cells. Again, I don't want to say we like this drug in CVID, but we're more comfortable with this sometimes because the B cells are already dysfunctional. If we knock them out, what harm are we doing? At least that's what we think. Now, there can be lots of side effects, and there can be infectious problems, so I'm not saying that that should be done all the time. But that's a very targeted treatment as opposed to the drugs on the left-hand side, which are a little less specific. Other targeted treatments against something called tumor necrosis factor. There's been a little bit of data, these are not big studies, but a little bit of data that in certain conditions, like granulomatous disease, those help some patients, but again, have a serious risk of infectious complications. And there's a lot of work on other very targeted cytokine inhibitors. These are like guided missiles that block or destroy one very specific part of the immune system. So there's a new one of these every month or two, and we're keeping our eye on that, but most of them have not been used or studied in rare conditions like CVID. And then in rare cases, splenectomy can help with some of the cytopenic issues, although there can be risks of infectious problems if your spleen is taken out, so that's certainly not the first line. Higher dose immunoglobulin and then a drug called hydroxychloroquine, which I still looked at. We still don't know how that drug works. I looked again yesterday. Nobody knows how it works, but it's helpful in some cases. All right. GI disease, and so the numbers there are up to 20%, again, from Charlotte's very large data set. In my experience, this is one of the biggest problems clinically that we deal with in CVID. Many of my patients have said this is the thing that interferes with their life the most, this is the thing that makes them the most miserable, and sadly, it's the thing I think we have the least data on in terms of what best to do for these conditions. So it runs the gamut from people having chronic diarrhea. That's the most common problem. Some people, if that's severe enough, will have malabsorption and weight loss. And in rare cases, you can actually get nutritional deficiencies from this. It's very uncommon, but I have cared for a few patients over the years that had to go on what's called TPN, nutrition through the veins, because their gut simply was not working anymore. Like the pulmonary list, this in the autoimmune list, it runs the gamut. Lots of things have been described causing problems in the GI tract. These run from infection, and these are usually kind of unusual infections. Things like Giardia, Cryptosporidium, norovirus, CMV. This speaks to the immunodeficiency. These are things that people with healthy immune systems, they get them, but they don't usually cause a big problem, and it's unusual for them to make people really sick for protracted periods of time. That can be an issue with CVID. There's something that looks like celiac disease, sprue-like illness, but most of the time has nothing to do with gluten. You can go on a gluten-free diet, and it won't make any difference in the symptoms, but it looks similar in terms of what the bowel looks like. Inflammatory bowel disease, you can get too much lymphoid tissue in the gut that can lead to some problems, and you can see so forth. There's a long list of things. Even lymphoma can rarely show up in the bowel and cause a lot of symptoms. So we really have to be careful and comprehensive in terms of thinking about these and having a very good workup done to make sure we don't miss something. Like most of what I've told you, we really don't understand why people with CVID are so predisposed to these GI issues, other than to say increasingly we recognize that the intestinal tract is a very rich and important environment for the immune system. So when there's dysregulation of immunity, I suppose it stands to reason that the GI tract would be heavily involved. Charlotte mentioned the memories or switched memory B cells. There's a little bit of data, and again, this is research, it's not been proven in the clinical setting, but that these low memory switch B cells may predict people that are predisposed to having chronic diarrhea or GI malabsorption. In terms of treatment, it's all over the board. So this just depends on what the problem is, what the diagnostic tests show. I think it's very important, and I'll revisit this at the end, to work with a specialist in your area who can take a very thoughtful, comprehensive look at this issue. And for the GI tract, it's a good gastroenterologist. which can be hard to find, just like it's hard to find a good immunologist sometimes. So we work very hard to hook our patients up with someone who's going to be thoughtful about this. Sometimes this also involves immunosuppressive therapy. And then what I'll get to what I call the laundry list now. So lymph node enlargement, lymphadenopathy, and an enlarged spleen, very common in common variable immunodeficiency. Most of this is benign, meaning it's not cancerous, it's not lymphoma, but we have to track it and watch it, and if it changes, the nature changes in terms of symptoms, or if you start to get fevers, chills, weight loss, we have to be aware that those can develop in rare cases to lymphoma. There's this strange condition called granulomatous disease. Some people have called it sarcoidosis, which is another granulomatous condition. It's probably a little bit different than sarcoidosis, but it shows up with these small inflammatory granulomas in really any organ system, but most often seen in the lungs, sometimes the liver. We don't know what causes this. There has been a little bit of research showing this could be related to a viral infection called HHV-8, but as you see, it only shows up in maybe 50 to 65% of the people that have this. So it's probably not the whole explanation. It may be a partial factor that drives these granulomas. And then finally, I think something that people worry about a lot is malignancy. And rightfully so, there is a increased risk of malignancy in patients with common variable immunodeficiency compared to those who do not have this condition. And that even holds true if you look at their relatives. So pretty much taking a lot of the same genes, but just the difference of having CVID, you see this risk in malignancy. Now, a lot of that, probably not the entire explanation, but a big chunk of that is this lymphoma risk. And we know that that's the greatest risk of malignancy in terms of percentages is with lymphoma. The best data shows between 8 and 10% of people with CVID will develop some form of lymphoma. So the good news is that means there's a 92% chance you'll never get this. That's what I try to emphasize to patients because they only hear that. We don't know exactly why. It may have something to do with the fact that these B cells that are mutated are overactive and dysregulated and start to turn on and don't ever turn off. There's some signal of an increase of gastric cancer in CVID. This seems to have tailed off a little bit in recent years. As you may know, there's a stomach infection called H. pylori, which is actually quite common. And if left untreated in certain people, that can evolve to start gastric cancer or be a factor for gastric cancer. As we've gotten better at looking for that and treating for it, it appears that the rate of gastric cancer has leveled off or decreased some in CVID. So we're hopeful that that may be the major driving factor, but the data is a bit unclear on that. With regard to looking for malignancy, I can only give you, you know, what we recommend for everyone else, which is do your appropriate screening, mammography, pap smears, colonoscopy, the usual stuff that's recommended by your internist to look for common cancers. In terms of lymphoma, we really don't have a good screening test. So I tell patients, you know, if you get persistent fevers that don't respond to antibiotics, you're having weight loss, if your lymph nodes start to enlarge dramatically and don't fluctuate, which sometimes they do, I would want to know about that because sometimes we have to go for a biopsy. And then the treatment, as you're sensing the theme here, the treatment is really what needs to be done for that condition. So we work with the oncologist. We, of course, caution them about the immunodeficiency, but you have to treat the malignancy effectively. So we work with them to try to make that as tolerable and as safe as we possibly can. This question comes up a lot, and I think there's a whole session on this at this meeting, which is nice. So CVID and allergy, and I will admit, when I was training, which is longer ago than you might think, I was taught this. So you have to choose between immunodeficiency and allergy. You don't have to get, you can't have both. You don't get to both. Turns out that's completely wrong. There was some rationale behind this. So as you may know, allergies are caused by IgE molecules. They look a lot like those IgG molecules, but they have a very different function. And IgE is something we can measure. So if you go for allergy testing or you take your kids for that, that's what we're looking for, IgE to specific things. When we find that, we know that there's a sensitization and you can react to those things in an allergic fashion. And it's really hard to find IgE in CVID patients because you don't make antibody very well. So if you don't make IgG very well, you don't make IgE very well in the vast majority of cases. This is not a B cell. You saw B cells. This is supposed to be a mast cell, M-A-S-T. That's why there's a sailboat on it to remind, so I don't forget the name. It's a mast cell. Mast cells are allergy cells. They release histamine and cause inflammation. And you can see these little symbols on there, those are supposed to be IgE. So you see there's one with a cat, there's one with a flower, there's one with a tree, there's one with a tornado, I noticed, which I don't really understand that one. But your mast cell gets loaded up with these allergic antibodies, and that's what causes allergy. So we used to think the dogma was, well, if you don't make IgG, you certainly don't make this IgE allergic antibody. Again, turns out that's wrong. So we know that people with CVID have lots of sinus and sinusitis issues and airway issues, and oftentimes you all tell us, and we will recognize it seems to be allergies, but it's hard to prove with testing because you don't make a lot of this IgE that we're used to measuring either on the skin or in the blood work. We now have data now, though, as of about 5 years ago, to show that this can be done, and in fact, you see that in, this was 60-some patients with CVID, you get positive allergy tests in 10% if you look for it, and you can actually cause asthma attacks in about 7% by exposing them to allergens. So now these numbers are lower than you see in the general population, certainly for allergy testing. We see 20 to 30% of the general population having some positive allergy tests. So it's less common, allergy is less common in CVID, but it certainly is possible and happens, and so don't let anybody tell you otherwise. We also do see certainly anaphylaxis, which is an IgE-mediated response in many cases, and other conditions that are really driven by IgE. Another common question I get, I'm so tired all the time, I'm fatigued, is this my CVID? And you're going to get tired of hearing me say I don't know, but I'm going to show you a quote to try to sugarcoat a little bit. I like this quote, for every complex problem there's a solution that's clear, simple, and wrong. This was in the 1900s, this guy was a journalist, and they say lots of, you know, crazy things. I actually think he got this one right. So I don't know. I hear it enough, and Charlotte and I have talked about this. I think it's probably a real phenomenon. I think there is something related to CVID that in certain people makes them feel lousy and have no energy. That said, I will reiterate what she said, which is a pet peeve of mine, is that everyone always blames everything on CVID once you have that diagnosis. And so it's important not to think that's the only thing that could be wrong. You got to do all the usual stuff. Check your blood counts, check your thyroid, check your vitamin levels, check, you know, get enough sleep, eat a good diet, all the stuff you learned in kindergarten. You got to do all that stuff. So that said, there may be something here. There's a little bit of research looking now. It's not very rigorous, but looking at cytokine levels, which are these chemicals in the bloodstream that the immune system puts out to signal other immune cells. And it's probably true, there's some mixed data, but that the cytokine profiles, which can cause fatigue and malaise and people to feel achy and lots of other things, those cytokine levels are probably look different in people with CVID than in people that don't have it. And so that would make some sense, I think, but it's very hard to prove these things because there's so much variability when you measure these chemicals. So I continue to think about this. I don't have the solution in terms of the fatigue. Now, just moving towards the end, a couple things on diagnostics. I mentioned this already. If you have diagnostic tests, remember that if you're getting IVIG, it will interfere with a lot of the assays that are done, a lot of the antibody-based tests. So we have to be careful in interpreting that. And the clinical evaluation becomes really important. That may be obvious to all of you, but working with people who have some experience in this realm, whether those are your nurses, your immunologist, or all the other specialists that sometimes need to be involved, it's really important that they take a close look at you and listen to your history and not rely entirely on laboratory work. And because we've reviewed all of these possible complications, it's my opinion that you really have to have a team approach when you have CVID. Charlotte's brilliant. I have my moments when I'm smart, but I don't know everything about all these things. And so you really have to go pick these people who can address these organ systems, whether it's GI, autoimmunity, or the like. You have to do regular monitoring. You have to, with home treatment, it's really important to keep your doctor in the loop. I can't tell you how many times I get blindsided, but, you know, patient X has been having this problem for 6 months and they don't know what to do about it. First I'm hearing about it. They're getting all their infusions at home and no one's telling me what's going on. So that feedback loop is really important to make your care as optimal as it can be. And so building this team and individualizing the treatment is important. So in the last 4 minutes I have, I'll just say a few words about the future. And I like this quote also, the universe is under no obligation to make sense to you. I think that's true. Doesn't mean we don't try. And so we keep trying to understand what's going on. I will put in my own plug. You heard about the research efforts, the registry, USIDNet, and the PI Connect effort now. It's really, really important. If you haven't gotten involved in that, please think about it. Research is always voluntary, but this is an easy way to contribute, I think. The only way that we're ever going to make substantial progress, and I should say continued progress, is if we all band together, because in rare conditions, the power is really in the numbers. So collecting the clinical data, the genetic testing through research means when we can do that, the laboratory data. And so USIDNet is, of course, the American effort. There's also a European effort and a Latin American effort. And at some level, globally, people get together and compare notes, and it's very helpful to make progress. There's a lot of hope with the genomics. I think this is really the future. We want to get away from this. Please try to suffer from the disease for which I'm treating you. Okay? There's so much variability, and as you've heard, there probably are quite a number of conditions that we're lumping together here in CVID, but we won't know that unless we have lots of data, lots of people that we can compare their genomics to see what's wrong in any given situation. I think you heard a little bit, you have heard a little bit about these genome-wide association studies, I think at the earlier sessions today. This is really looking at the entire genome, all your genetic information that's in your DNA, and trying to sort out where the problem lies. And I've shown you how CVID has all of these possible issues. Many people have only one or two of these. Some people have a full house and they've got a bunch of them. And we'd really like to understand what is it that causes that and predicts that. So, it holds a lot of promise, but I have trouble digesting this myself. Has anybody read War and Peace? I am very impressed. I'm very intimidated by the size of that book. I have not read it. War and Peace has about 3 million letters in it. I'm told. I didn't count them, but I'm told. The human genome is made up of amino acids, and that sequence in a person has 3 billion letters in it. Okay. So just to demonstrate the challenge of trying to sift through the genome and see where the problem is, here's the analogy. You take War and Peace, and in order to get enough letters for the human genome, you have to stack 1,000 War and Peace volumes up, which is equivalent to about an 18-story building. Okay? So that's the volume of data that we're trying to sift through. Not me, but people who are experts in this. And then you're going to take those pages, and you're going to shred them. Because that's what you have to do to sequence. You've got to shatter this into pieces that you can work with. Because it's this huge, long, enormous strand. And technology is doing this faster and better than ever. But you end up with an enormous pile of letters that you have to go through and piece them back together. And not only that, now you've got to figure out where the misprint is. Where's the word that was spelled wrong? Okay, so just to give you an idea of the enormous task, that's why it takes all this effort and money and years to do this. And furthermore, as you've heard, we're probably not likely to find one word misspelled. You might find a bunch of words misspelled, and now you got to figure out how does that work? Why is that important that they all fit together and cause this problem? So this is a paper from a few years ago led by Jordan Orange. People are trying to do this. This was looking at to see, this is called allelic frequency, which is one way to look at the DNA, a part of the DNA. And you can't read it very well, I'm sorry, but on the left-hand side it says cancer, lymphoma, lymphadenopathy, bronchiectasis, granuloma, malabsorptions, cytopenias. These are all the manifestations we've just talked about. The goal here is to find a signature. Can I find a signature in a person that says, yep, we know this is going to happen, we can predict this is going to happen because of the genetic signature. But in order to do that, you've got to find the very distinct, all the things that have gone wrong in the genome. So this is a step, a very exciting step, but it's going to take a lot of work to figure out. And you need lots and lots of people to make this work because of the natural, normal variability in DNA. This is another way to look at it. This is looking for novel candidate gene mutations. They call this a Manhattan plot. I think it's because Charlotte lives and works in New York City. But no, it looks kind of like skyscrapers. That's why they call it Manhattan plot. But this is actually taking that same genomic DNA and seeing, can we find an abnormality, a change that's so much different in these people that have common variable as opposed to people that don't have it? And you can see there's actually two really good candidates here. And I think these showed up on your slide that Charlotte showed you. So this is another way to discover genetic variations that may be causative or important factors. But again, you have to have lots of people with CVID, and you got to have lots of people that don't have it in order to tell if this is an important change or not. So the last thing I'll show you, because I do get questions about this, relates to stem cell transplant. And again, if you were at the breakfast this morning, you already saw this, but if you weren't, I just want to make sure I address that question quickly. This is the 25 patients that were just published this year, the global experience, at least in published form, of CVID patients that have undergone a stem cell transplant, which is basically a bone marrow transplant, a more elegant way to do bone marrow transplant. And what I want to point out a couple of things. Most of these patients, in fact, 21 of them were being transplanted for something besides infections. Okay, so these are people that have lots of other problems that we've just talked about. Most of them had major autoimmune or granulomatous problems. So that was the reason for the transplant. They were so sick, their life expectancy was not good at all. A few of them had lymphoma, and so they received transplants for that reason. And so what I'll show you is, now the bad news is that the mortality rate was 50%, basically. So half of the people died going through this procedure, which is why we don't do it much at all right now. It's simply still too risky to recommend for most people. The good news is that those who were being treated, their CVID-associated problems went away. It actually worked for what it was intended to work for. So the autoimmunity, the granulomatous problems, it seemed to cure those. And in the people who survived, about half of them were able to get off immunoglobulin therapy. So that means half of them still had to do their infusions, but they didn't have all the other problems that had been associated with their CVID. So there's a lot of data here, and I don't want to get bound up in the details, but just when you ask about this, this is the answer, is that it still, at least so far, is very risky. So we've got to develop better ways. We've got to be develop better ways to identify people who this may make sense for. And that's part of this genetic signature. If you could predict ahead of time that this is going to be a problem for you, you know, in a few years or in the future, because a lot of the mortality with transplantation relates to how sick are you when you start. And so people do better if they're not quite so sick. These people are all, of course, very sick, which was the reason to do the procedure. So here's where I think we stand. We are managing CVID. We have not solved it. I give this student points for creativity. Find X, here it is. It's easy, right? But you manage this problem, and we're simply managing this. We'd like to be able to solve it, to cure it, of course, and that's always the goal. So I thank you for being here. I think together we have a lot ahead of us. A lot can be accomplished. And I'm from Missouri, so I'm a big Mark Twain fan. I haven't read War and Peace, but I've read Mark Twain. I like this. Apparently, there's nothing that cannot happen today. I think that's true, and I think that's what we should keep in mind over the weekend. Thanks very much.